quick welcome to Civic Engineers. Thank you very much for everyone coming along tonight for this Club Peloton associated evening. Most of you, I think a lot of people come because they're connected to Club Peloton, and those of you who haven't, very much welcome. There's a few guys from Club Peloton here, so if you are interested in getting involved in the Club Peloton events, I'm sure I'd love to talk to you about it. I'm going to hand over directly to Judith, who is our chair for this evening, and we'll crack on.
Use this. Does that work better? Hi everyone. My name is Judith Sykes. I'm a director at Expedition Engineering, which is part of the Useful Simple Trust. So thank you very much for Civic Engineers for hosting us and to Club Peloton putting on this event. I'm going to give you just a little bit of an overview of what we're thinking about in terms of circular economy in the built environment, and then we're going to have some very punchy, pithy, I hope, presentations from our panellists, who I'll introduce as we go through, and then hopefully we'll finish up by 12:30 and we can then have open Q&A, finish up by 7, so we finish by 7:30 to have more drinks and more networking. So here we go. So I was reflecting on, it's about 4 years since we published the guidance on the circular economy policy for London. At the time of writing it, it felt quite theoretical. There were very few case studies that we could actually put forward in the guidance, which really illustrated what we meant by a comprehensive approach to circularity. But now all major schemes in London have to be referable. And I think actually it's really promoted understanding about circular economy and materials in the built environment, not least, you know, things like the M&S building, the press that got when it was going to be demolished. I think it's much more in the discourse is how we value materials in the built environment. And the reason why the built environment is so important is really nicely captured in this recent report, The Circularity Gap. If you haven't read it, it came out a few weeks ago. It's really interesting, but it does say that the two of the four key sectors which are responsible for overshoot are associated with the built environment in mobility and the buildings that we operate. So we are responsible for a lot. We have a lot in our hands. The other thing I think is quite interesting that we've seen is this sort of decline in the cost of resources over the last sort of 100 years is shifting as a result of reaching peak supply of materials, but also growing demand from the emerging economies. And this is a plot taken from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and it just shows you that sort of tipping point in resource costs, which makes it way more attractive for bringing back materials and resources and valuing them more than we have done in the past. And I've just come back from the Venice Biennale, and there was a real mix of exhibits from the sort of neon-type view of what a future looked like. But I thought I'd show you this image of the German pavilion, which I think was by miles the best and most thought-provoking. When you walk in, you think you're in a DIY store, but actually each of these materials is coded with a little QR code. And when you scan it, you find out where that material's come from. And it's all waste products from the previous Venice Biennales coded up. And they were only able to capture 5% of all the waste from that Biennale. So I think it was a really good point. And the purpose of this session today is to do that, is to take that meta picture and come up and put forward some practical examples of how we're implementing the circular economy. So I will introduce our first speaker, who is Dr. Simon Hadley from AHMM. So Simon is an architect and researcher, specialist in delivering sustainable design. He's worked with several architectural practices, including HLM, Shepherd Epstein Hunter and Scott Brownwig. And he, most importantly, is doing doctoral research with UCL on approaches to delivering low-carbon buildings. And he's now working with HMM to explore those approaches to delivering net zero carbon buildings through that collaboration with UCL. So over to you, Simon, 5 minutes, please.
Thank you.
Here's the clicker.
One of the, as Judith mentioned, I've recently been involved in a research project with UCL's Institute of Environmental Design and Engineering. And it was looking at approaches to developing large-scale net zero carbon buildings. One of kind of the fundamental aspects of this was kind of looking at how do we define a net zero carbon building and the kind of key elements to it. And over the course of the research, one of the things that kind of came through was with this kind of interrelationship of the circular economy with aspirations for delivering net zero. And this is both in with regard to the upfront carbon and kind of reusing materials where we can, consideration of the life of a building, but also the capacity of a design for to allow the recovery of the materials at the end of a building's life. And as I said, we fundamentally took a kind of whole life carbon approach to this, considering things like the use of materials, materials passports, design for disassembly, loose fit, and those sorts of things. But it was also interesting that there was kind of a kind of data infrastructure element to delivering both net zero carbon and the circular economy, and that's kind of related to capturing data about the materials that we put into our buildings and pulling data out of or information out of kind of our knowledge of existing buildings or our understanding of existing buildings, and being able to and that kind of informs our ability to kind of deploy the circular economy, and it's kind of it was also a kind of key part of it. There were kind of a number of case studies that informed the research. This is actually one that didn't actually make the net zero carbon guide, which was the chief output, but it was influential nevertheless. And this is Finsbury Avenue Square, which is being developed by British Land. And unfortunately, this is one of the kind of bad case studies in the sense that it was a demolition and rebuild, but there were some really kind of interesting elements to how that was approached. First was the, as I said, this kind of process of capturing data about the building, the existing building, and kind of in order so it could be kind of utilised in the kind of later stages. Another aspect was the use of materials passports, kind of looking forward, but also the employment of metrics to kind of quantify the application of the circular economy. And that was done through the use of the MADASTA platform, which kind of uses its own metric based on the Ellen MacArthur Foundation Material Circularity Index. And there was kind of a slightly dull aspect to that, in that it kind of meant that there was a whole set of documentation around, like, pulling data from the BIM models into the materials passports and the digital twins and those sorts of things, and circularity kind of matrices and stuff. But it did kind of lead to some interesting design responses. So one of the most interesting ones was the external stonework was disassembled and reused in the finishes. So the terrazzo floors and that's kind of in the, going into the new building is essentially the existing facade that's crushed up and reused, and I thought that was kind of an interesting, one of the more kind of more interesting design responses that arose from that.
Thank you very much, Simon. So we're now going to hand over to a bit of a team presentation from Gareth, Sarah and Tom, and just to quickly introduce them. So Gareth obviously is our host this evening, director at Civic Engineers, leading on civil and structural engineering across a number of sustainable retrofit and extension of and buildings which are extended. He is also on the NLA panel, Net Zero Expert Panel. We've got Sarah from the Four Partnership, who's an associate director leading up on their development arm, and they're leading particularly on TBC London Bridge, which I think is the project that we're going to be talking about. And then Tom, who's got a wide range of experience across commercial, education and retail schemes, so knows his buildings and is a director at Webb Yates Engineers. So over to you for your triple act, please. Here we go.
Thank you very much. So this is a bit of a story, this one. So the case study starts with 318 Oxford Street, which is a project here at Civic Engineers. Other people might know it as the House of Fraser on Oxford Street. So we're busy retrofitting this building to change it from what is currently one retail store into it being just retail on the basement, ground and first floor, fronting onto Oxford Street, and then changing the use. So it's got some gym use in the back, it's got offices, and it's got restaurants on the top. And as part of the key part of the retrofit is that we're having to create some additional vertical circulation because of different uses. So we're cutting some holes through the building and then taking a floor off so we can put some more on. It's got some load balancing, also extending some pieces out as well. The building was built in the 1930s and is constructed from steelwork, primarily with precast concrete slabs. Here's a picture from the 1930s showing it being constructed. Photo on the left there showing the health and safety which was in place to erect those buildings at that time. But what was really interesting, because we didn't have any as-built drawings from the 1930s, we did have these photographs, and these photographs are actually incredibly detailed, and you could zoom right in. If you had this photo on your screen, you can go and see on the right-hand side, there's horse and carts there, and there's low back lorries with precast elements. But most importantly for us was this, which was the sign which showed who the steel contractor was for the project. Steel fabricator. And back in the 1930s, there was various different fabricators, and they all produced their steelwork slightly differently. But it helped unlock understanding for this project, because we were able to go back and find their fabrication books and then look at what the steelwork was. And what was quite interesting is we found on this project that the steel columns in the middle of the building were actually completely solid. And that's because apparently it was cheaper and easier to build them that way compared with today, where we'll roll them and turn them into hollow sections. So as part of the work, we wanted to see whether we could, with the additional stories, see whether we could use some of the steelwork we're taking out to build the new stories. So it's a circular economy within the same building. What that meant was when we were taking off stories, we had to go and do an audit of the steelwork, which was being removed. And here you can see the roof and the seventh floor, looking at the different size sections which were available. A lot of the beams and the columns were made up of sections, so they had extra plates attached to them to make them stronger, and that was done by attaching with a whole series of rivets. The other thing we needed to do was establish exactly how strong they were. And so we carried out a whole series of tests from different parts of the building, cutting sections out. You can see on the right-hand side, they were encased in concrete, and that was for fire protection, to take sections out and go away to testing labs to find out how strong they were. And typically, they were coming back around section 235. And now today, the steelwork grade is around about 355. So it's a little bit weaker, but still very usable for building structures. So what we're going to do, can we reuse them on the same site? And the answer was yes. So we took some columns, and we've got those, and we've kept them aside. It's currently on site at the moment, and they've been kept aside, ready for the fabricator to go put them together. And we've specified those on our new drawings to go and be part of the new structure for additional stories. We also looked to see if we could use some of it on another site. But one of the big problems with these beams, especially where they're made up of lots of plates, is it's very difficult to put them into new buildings, especially when you've got precast panels or metal decking, because the top of the beams are actually undulating and changing. So that was very tricky, and we were unable to get that done. And the other one was go out to the open market and see if we could get some of this steelwork out there rather than it just being taken away and melted down for reuse in that way. So they're the columns which are now taken down, and they're being reused for the construction of the new stories. And then there was a little bit of brokering going on, and this is where I'm going to pass on to Tom in a minute, because which links back to Club Peloton really in many, many ways, and why we're sat here tonight. Was I was on a bike ride last summer with Basil from Four. Sarah Hips here from Four tonight. And I said, we've got loads of steelwork and we don't know what to do with it. And straight away he went, I'll have it. I'll have it. I said, you're joking. And he goes, no, I've got just the building. He told which building. I said, oh, I know that. It's just down the road from our studio. I said, the engineer's going to go mad at you. He doesn't want to change his design now. He goes, oh, we'll talk to them. It'll be fine. We'll be fine. Bearing in mind the contractor was already on site and procuring steelwork in the normal fashion. So anyway, for being a developer, very sustainably led, they really wanted to push this. And so it was from that idea that we managed to quite quickly broker some deals back through with the demolition contractor to actually keep some of the steelwork and sell it to Four, and then for Web Yates to see what they could do with it. And at that point, I'm going to hand over.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Right, so a quick overview of Tower Bridge Court. I didn't really include one, but I thought actually maybe it makes a bit more sense. So the building is literally like 5 minutes walk that way. A lot of you may have come past it as you were coming from the station. We are taking two stories off to go up Four. It's a bit of an odd structural frame at the moment. It's a kind of rib slab concrete, but it's got void formers in it, and we're moving two cores around, and we're putting in quite a lot of steelwork, which is against our kind of general approach to life as Web Yates. I've lost the picture. Oh, there we go, the other one. So we've got two types of reuse at Tower Bridge Court. One is the steelwork we're taking from Oxford Street, which is what we would call a donor building, and then we're also using steel from Cleveland steelwork, which has lost its provenance. So that is steel that they've lost the testing certificates for. It's modern-based steel. It's got good strength to it, but otherwise would go back into the recycling mills because nobody will buy it. So a little bit for the engineers in the room. This is the design guidance you need to know about. I'm not going to cover it in detail because most of you will go to sleep. But actually, a lot of this design guidance is quite modern, quite new, especially the first two, P427 and the addendum to 427, which is only written last year, which is about use of steelwork, which is older than what we would call modern. So the general steelwork that we have on site, there are a number of kind of criteria we need to look at as to whether we can use it, i.e. get rid of built-up members. Those are the members where you've got plates on plates on plates with rivets or welds. No splice members, no significant loss due to corrosion. So these are now we're into the kind of main key ones. What we're looking for is something that isn't badly corroded and really has no evidence of plasticity, excessive plasticity, i.e. it's not been deformed so far that it can't spring back. Localised deviations and tolerance issues that we'll cover in a minute can be accommodated. So that is actually one of our beams that you can see on the screen at the moment. So we've tested near enough every member of steel on the group. We've typically bundled them into groups of section sizes, and we've tested six, but actually the way that the steel came to us, that's actually an indicator. We've almost tested every single piece of steel for its yield strength, which is basically the point at which it goes plastic, the ultimate strength, the point at which it fails, and in key elongation, so we want to make sure that the steel behaves in a ductile fashion, not a brittle fashion. So that means that you get a progressive failure rather than a sudden failure in the steelwork, if that ever happened, and in impact toughness and weldability, which are important for connections. And again, this is another piece of our steelwork. It didn't come off site very well, thanks Gareth for that. just a broken, not my problem. So one of the things we have to do is go through all the steelwork and really identify defects, and that's a really key part of the process. Existing buildings are used, they are cut, they are carved, they have services running through them, they get refit, they have more services cut through them. people don't change the steelwork as it is. So this is a typical section of steel. You know, at the top we've got dent in the top flange, which means it's going to be difficult to land anything on it. But actually, if the bottom flange is fine, you just flip the beam over and ease it, and equals it orientation. Keep an eye on the defect. So this is a defect with a bubbling deformation in the web, because we'll come to that in a minute. So as Gareth said, we have what is effectively called S235 steel. Actually, the chemical makeup meant it was somewhere in between S235 and S275. S275 is kind of the minimum modern day steel you'd get. I would call this steel furniture steel, and so the things you would make furniture out of. But actually, in my past life, we've done some quite exciting things with furniture steel, so it's still reasonably useful. Every single bit of steel gets a fabrication drawing, picking up all of its defects. So this is X19, and this is X19 on site. So you can see the holes, and you can see the defect that we picked up earlier on the photos. And that is me done.
Thanks. So from a four perspective, I think first of all, we like to give everyone a challenge. So if you do want to work for us, one, sustainability is at the heart of all we do, and two, we like to be really progressive. Even if we bought a contract, that doesn't mean that's what we're going to deliver. Paul's here and he knows the headaches that we do in terms of really trying to push the boundaries. And like Gareth says, this is obviously something born off a bike ride, and we came to sort of about September, October time that we knew that this steel was coming. But then as of about probably 6 weeks ago, we then gave the additional headache of saying, can we get any more steel from Cleveland, who are seemingly the only suppliers who you can get this steel from? And so just for context, we're putting the original, let's call it the original, the House of Fraser steel on the third and fourth floor. And then we're using the top two floors for the additional steel. And really it's just trying to see how much we can use, because it's important. If steel were a country, it would be the fourth largest polluter of carbon. So actually this is something that makes a really big difference. So if we're going to target something, this is it. And I think one of the big things that we need to do is have more companies like Cleveland who are there and available to get it from, because at the moment they don't have a lot of stock and people are wanting to do this. Unless you buy from a demo contractor like we did, it is cost effective, and it definitely can come in cheaper than your traditional, or at least this is what the QSs are telling us. It can come in cheaper than new steel. You do have to make the design team work hard, and you have to have a design team who wants to come with you on that journey. And also for us, the big thing is actually wanting the contractor to do it as well, and their subcontractor and their supply chain. So we've got to make sure, from an insurance perspective, everyone's happy and everyone knows. But ultimately, that comes down to testing and just proving that it's exactly the same as if you were getting new steel, apart from it's got a few dents in it. But otherwise, yeah, you're all right. It's fine. Actually, it's really making the team go, yeah, we want to do this. We want to do something different. And I think that's a really important part of tender processes, is just getting the contractor on board to want to do it. Something else that we're looking at as for, just because we're talking about other elements, is raised access floors. I think that's starting to come on the journey. A big part of that, because we've spoken to this, that again, only seems to really be one company. Kingspan, if you talk to them, will tell you don't do it. But there seems to be one subcontractor who is really willing to warrant it. But not all raised access floor tiles can be reused. But you can just send them a picture and they'll go, yep, we can reuse that. Turns out not every raised access floor that looks the same is the same. And yeah, that's one of the things that we're looking at. And it's taking all elements of the property journey, like property team on the journey. So I think most people in this room sit here from a design side and a construction and delivery. That's what I came from. I now sit on the client side, and therefore part of my role is talking to letting agents and going, you're not going to have a shiny floor. It might have, like, yes, we'll have cleaned it, but it's not going to be perfectly polished, but it's got a story to it. Bringing any potential tenants on board, and everyone's there going, yeah, I've got this strategy for net zero, this is what I want to be, and then they go, oh, but there's a mark on that raised access wall, I'm going to put my carpet tile on top. Like, we've got to, as a society, I think, start talking about that, because that's how it's going to change people's mind. And I think that's what everyone in this room can sort of do, is go, actually, do we notice if you've got a little dent in something? Would we probably prefer to pay a little bit less for our iPhone because it's got a dent? Yeah, probably would, because I'm going to drop it anyway, or put a case on it. So I think that's my sort of take home, is actually we just need to start talking about going, are imperfections really a bad thing, or are they a good thing? Because actually, if we're happy with imperfections, that's fine. That's the circular economy. Imperfection is okay. Imperfection is good because it's sustainable.
Thank you very much. That was brilliant. An amazing case study. I'm just reminded of the ugly fruit bin now when you're in the supermarket. You're talking about that. Okay, we're going to have one more last speaker. Before I introduce her, get your questions ready. I'd like to have them for the panel. So, Laura, over to you. Just to introduce you, you're from Haynton still, and Laura's role is primarily looking at leading their research focus, and so in particular developing HTS's understanding and practical implementation of low carbon buildings and circular structural design. Prior to that, her project experience includes the refurbishment of the Grade 2 listed Hornsey Town Hall and a number of private residences. Over to you. Hi everyone. I'm also going to talk about steel reuse because we have an interesting case study that I will show you right now. So this is Seven Holbein Gardens, which is a job that achieved practical completion earlier this year, and the steel frame was completed last year. This is our first experience of a finished project that incorporated reused steel, and I've yet to be proven wrong about this, but I think it's the first commercial building in London that has reused steel in the permanent works. So this is a pretty small scale project, but going through from start to finish, we've learned a lot, went through all the headaches, understood what the sticking points were, and so using this as a starting point, we've been able to propose reused steel on a lot more projects. So you'll see just the headlines there. A third of the steel was from reused stocking in the end. It was a demolished mansard roof and then two stories put back on top of a building in Belgravia. And as I said, it was completed in 2022. So I'll just talk through a little bit about where the steel came from and how it was incorporated into the design. So the initial aspiration was to reuse the steel that was on site already. Just because it was there, it was available, it was part of the client's ownership, it seemed straightforward. But actually looking at the programme, it wouldn't have worked out because this steel would have had to be dismantled, sent up to Cleveland Steel to be tested, re-warranted, and then brought back down to site, and that didn't work with the overall project programme. So that was plan A. Plan A didn't work out. So in the meantime, the client identified other sites in their portfolio nearby that might have programs that would work out. So they found two sites. One was the old US Embassy in Grosvenor Square, and the other one was the biscuit factory. And so steel was procured from there, and they were able to get it at the right time. Also send it up to Cleveland Steel to get it tested, warrantied, brought back down, and made part of the permanent works at Holbein Gardens. At the very end of the design stage, kind of late stage four, the team at HTS got a call from Cleveland Steel saying, oh, we've got some other stock that might be suitable. Would you like it?
So the design team, I wasn't part of the design team, but I'm told they quickly reevaluated the sections, worked them into the structural model, made sure they fit in terms of you know, the geometry and aesthetically that they were suitable, and so that was a number of sections were found suitable, and they just were added to the pile from Cleveland Steel and brought back down to London. And so it's hard to talk with the slides behind me craning my neck. So that kind of presented a challenge, like I said, about really quick redesign, having to double check that the section is, because you're never going to find the exact right section that you want right at the right time, making sure that the alternate is suitable, and that requires a little bit of flexibility on the engineer's part, but nothing that they couldn't handle. So I'll just kind of finish on this summary. I think one of the really important things is to... I need to actually read this off now. Just to understand that, like I said, you've designed a beam, it's the optimum size, you're not going to find that size in the right length and the right at the right time. So there has to be a little bit of flexibility on the design, whether that's up front, whether that's at the end, to just kind of recheck designs as they come in. We have to be willing to be flexible on the design side. And that just basically includes feedback from, you know, seeing what's in stock, what's available, and being able to roll it in. Talking to experienced stockists is very important. So Cleveland Steel has been mentioned a lot tonight. There's also another one called EMR. Those are the two big players in this game in the UK. And Deconstruct is also part of this, but they tend to work more on temporary works. I think the two established, Cleveland Steel has been established for like 40 years, and they have a huge site. They actually have lots of stock, so they're pretty well established. EMR used to, or EMR do, it stands for European Metal Recycling, and they've recently started to kind of sidetrack some of their scrap steel for reuse. So these are two big players in this game. The fact that you need so much storage land, in my mind, makes it really tricky for someone else to enter. It's going to be a hard market to enter. So for now, we might be stuck with these two, but they're both great, so it's fine. And then, yeah, just from kind of our perspective, understand the testing requirements. The testing requirements are very straightforward. As was previously mentioned, understanding aesthetic requirements is also important, especially if they're going to be exposed, because they come in with all sorts of stuff and dings and you know, holes and bits missing, none of which poses a structural concern, but can be, it tells a story, doesn't it? And then finally, I guess, is that we shouldn't be aiming for 100% reuse. We should be aiming for as much as we can, but don't throw in the towel if you can't get 100% reuse, or if something goes wrong at the last minute. Even a bit of reuse is better than nothing. So I will leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we should give all our speakers a big round of applause. And I have a really badly placed column, so if you want to wave at me, I'll just try and go this way. But please, if you've got questions, or shall I start the ball rolling? I'm going to start the ball rolling. Okay, I'm going to ask Gareth. How do you get from serendipity, which is effectively what happened on your cycle ride, to something more scalable in terms of that knowledge exchange about where materials are coming from and moving to?
It's working. I think slightly corny, but the sort of Club Peloton family really, really helped with this whole process, because I already knew Tom through cycling and Club Peloton. So it was a relationship which was already there, which I could call him up and say, Tom, I've got to have this really crazy idea. I've met one of your clients, and he think it'd be really cool to use some steelwork out of one of our buildings. And knowing Webb Yates and Tom in particular, and you'd jump at it anyway. But those sort of relationships which we've got within the industry with us here today and working collaboratively across engineering practices can really, really help with in the early days of steel reuse, can really, really help with moving it on and sharing it across sites. I mean, Laura's very lucky to have a client who's got lots of sites who happen to be able to share them in amongst different sites. But in these early days, the industry isn't there. I fully believe that it will pick up incredibly quickly, because as more and more developers have to develop buildings with less and less carbon, they're going to be looking towards recycled materials, and that is only going to then become probably financially profitable for the likes of Cleveland Steel and many others who are going to get on board and go, do you know what, we'll take that steel work, we'll go and put it in our yard, and do you know what, we'll get it tested and ready for you. So, sorry, I'm slightly drifted off your question, but...
It sounds like what you're saying is actually it's going to be people like Cleveland Steel and EMR are going to develop the market for us, you know, and make those relationships happen. Or there's a role, the other sort of way, the role of digital platforms and things like the excess materials exchange that Enfield have set up in way of sort of brokering those relationships.
Yeah, I think so. It's data banks of buildings. Yeah. I'm sure we can probably move on to that in a minute, but people, you're going to own buildings, and actually people might start looking at their buildings and their assets instead of looking at the building, might go, actually, I've got a real asset here, which is a whole load of good materials, which is demountable and could sell it for some good money on the circular economy.
I can see itching to come in is both Sarah and Laura, so I guess,
I was just going to agree with you. I think a really valuable part is us all crash testing this and then sharing with each other. Before we get to the more higher level like data story and all that stuff, it's just really learning from each other's experience. So I'd really echo that sentiment that having like three engineers in the same room talking about this and our lessons learned is the very first step. And I can say like we're very much taking this step.
I think from my side, a lot of developers, and particularly in London, less so perhaps in the regions, are talking about net zero in operation, and very few people are talking about embodied carbon. As embodied carbon and people start realising that Leti exists, there's targets there, we should be tracking that, this is going to come forward. And I think that's the difference. Like for us, we take all aspects, so we use Leti for construction, we use UKGBC for setting our targets of what the building is, and we're using neighbours to make sure that in use we're actually standing by what we said from the start, and we're looking at the whole process. I think we're in the minority, well, we're definitely in the minority. And as that starts to really set people apart, that's when it's going to come in. But I think until, like, it's great that we all exist and we all talk, but actually, from a client's perspective, until you're probably forced to, and I think until that's being forced by tenants saying, oh, are you looking at embodied carbon? Like, we only need to look at the press of going, okay, are people really looking at actually the carbon that we do in construction, not just in use? And everyone talks about net zero, and people need to start talking about embodied.
So I was really struck by your presentation about that role of client, and I wanted to ask Simon about the material banks project and the degree to which the clients really engage with that as a philosophy.
I mean,
and more practically as well.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of one of the projects where the client really drove it, but didn't really kind of understand what they were driving towards. And I think that's kind of one of the issues with the circular economy at the moment is that it can be quite nebulous. And there are lots of different components to it. You know, there's the way in which you treat the existing building, and there's the way in which you kind of forward plan for the life of the building and how it's disassembled. And so there was a certain amount of kind of interpretation, and kind of one aspect to it that I didn't mention in the presentation was that we actually had another consultant on board to kind of assist with the circular economy aspects of it, and that was the research arm of the Danish practice 3XN, which is GXN, and they kind of provided that extra bit of kind of insight in order to kind of pick apart this kind of element of the brief.
Perfect. All right, I'm going to see if there's any hands on the floor. Yes, Julia.
One, two. Hi, Julian from Civic. I'm interested in a couple of things about the steel that went from 318 Oxford Street to your project, Tom, and TBC down the road. The first question is a technical one, really, which is, and I'm asking this question in light of the fact that we're about to do another project with Renew Steel at the moment. I'm trying to avoid problems. is the warranty provider for the development, I think you both mentioned it, how interested in the testing regime of the steel were they? Did they sort of dictate to you how much testing and what they would need to get comfortable with in order to provide the warranty that the developer needed ultimately?
The easy answer is they weren't that interested. So as long as we were following technical guidance, so at this point in time, if you follow the British Standard Code and you do a design, nobody asks you about the warranty for your steelwork that you're designing that's brand new. So there are various publications that are out there. I put a few up on the slide, but the Steel for Reuse Guide is one, and in there they specify a testing regime, which is actually only one member per group. Now, that, depending on the size of the group, that may be quite a large proportion or a small proportion of that sample size. But as long as you're testing for those kind of six main criteria that come out of that document, and you can satisfy yourself that steel is used in that to that material testing, and you can say that you have... So that's one part of the steel reuse, that deals with the materiality of the product that you've got. You've then, on top of that, got to take into account the imperfections in the section, which, depending on the type of steel you've got, may be large or small. So the steelwork we got from Oxford Street had what I would call high imperfections in it due to its manufacturing process, the fact it was concrete encased, and the demolition contractor was a little bit rough with that, which means it had high imperfections. So all you do is you design those imperfections into your design, and you're downgrading the steel grade. So I said, the actual steel quality sits somewhere between 235 and 275, but you have to basically drop it back down to the nearest compliant steel grade. So actually, it's stronger than 235, but actually drop it down, and that's the one it complies to most readily. Take into account the imperfections and design those through, and we had no, as far as I'm aware, warranty issues, unless you had any.
No, and also just to clarify, that's the insurance, not the warranty. So we're not, the warranty process that we have is exactly the same as any other project. It was more just in terms of the building insurance and making sure that's so. I think that was your question, is probably more insurance rather than warranty. So just to sort of clarify this, in terms of the warranty perspective that you see on every other project, it's exactly the same. We haven't changed anything differently. So what Tom has explained is exactly what was there. There were more questions that were asked from an insurance perspective, and that's obviously what had to be provided to satisfy the insurance.
Okay. So am I right in summarising then that the insurers are happy if you are happy?
Basically, because they'll come and see us or see you or whoever's done the design. So I think the one thing I would add is the engineer needs to show quite a lot of diligence, and so does the fabricating team in inspecting that steelwork. You can't assume it's perfect, and we've got hundreds of photos of dings and dents and this, that, and the other, and we kind of tried to log them all to make sure we had at least a level of certainty over what we were doing, and you need that data to take it through into the design process. It would be different, and I think in the example we're given from Hain Tillett Steel, that steel was much more modern than the steel that we had, and therefore, and probably, and by the looks of it, it looked in good nick, so probably it's come out of a building where maybe it's not been so encased in concrete, the demolition process was easier, maybe you're just unbolting things rather than cutting welds and various other things with that. So it really depends on where the steel's coming from, how old that steel is, and how you're going to use it, really.
Dory, do you want to add any commentary to that on the project appearance analysis?
No, I don't think so. Thank you for covering it. Thanks. I won't bore you with more.
It's really, the devil's in the detail insurance. Really interesting question, but over to this gentleman.
Yes, Simon. I'm testing Jackson's steel.
Yeah, I did. So the question was, how much of the testing rejected the steel? All the testing doesn't reject steel. Testing says this is what the steel is, and it's for us to make a decision on whether we want to use it or not. Actually, all the steelwork passed the requirements we needed it to in terms of the material testing. There were elements of steel that were bent, buckled, and whatever, and we just had to get rid of them. I think the stats from Tower Bridge Court are 40 tonnes of steel supplied, about 20 tonnes of steel went back in into the building. So there's 50% wastage there. Part of that would have been the steel that we had come to site had shelf angles on it, which we had to get rid of. We weren't going to use those, so that automatically went to scrap. They were burnt off ends, so we had to shorten the beams back to a length where we could use them, refabricate connections to them. So there's an element of wastage with that. And then some of the steel was slightly corroded and various other bits with that. So that selection process is not just about testing the material. It's about going through and making sure that steelwork fits within those parameters of, is it a built-up section? Well, yes. Have you tested the welds? No, can't use it. Or are you going to test the welds? Or can you unbolt that section and reduce it down? So most of the wastage came from either the demolition process, i.e. we couldn't reuse those parts, or we just had to trim it to suit our own site, and then you end up with lengths that you can no longer use again.
Looking out to the floor.
A slightly less technical question, if that's okay. We're obviously talking to the Enlightened Few in the room, and obviously that's great, but how do you expect to bring this to wider adoption, I think? And obviously, it's also about net zero, and people are obviously going to be forced into the position anyway. But do we need further policy? Do we hope for a better government? Do we, where are we heading with this? How do we actually drive this adoption? It's kind of a bit of a rush, I guess.
Carbon tax?
I think there is gradually policies coming into place on the local authority level, the GLA, in terms of new buildings, and you've got to meet embodied carbon targets, and they're coming down, the LETI targets, scores targets, and what that's meaning is that developers are having to work harder and harder in design, particularly of new buildings or extensions to buildings. Whether that's having more columns, we've got columns at 3 meter grids, we're all sat in here, I know there's, you can't maybe all see me, but it has a vast difference on the embodied carbon in a structure compared to big long spans. But also, if you want to continue to to have open plan spaces, then reusing existing steelwork, which has obviously got around between, I think, 10 and 20% of the embodied carbon compared with recycled steelwork, is something which contractors, developers, are going to willingly pay more so they can meet their embodied carbon targets.
Yeah, I can echo the other panellists' comments in the sense that obviously we need both policy, but we also need changes in culture and both in how we kind of treat reuse of materials and spaces in general. I think also that there's an element of, a big part of it is infrastructure. One of the constraints is just the ability to store the materials until they need to be used. And so we kind of need to be thinking of like Amazon's sheds on the outskirts of town that are kind of storing all of these building materials until they're needed. And then on top of that, there's kind of the digital infrastructure as well, these kind of databases that actually I know where, so a designer knows where to find the materials when they're needed again. So,
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. I think that infrastructure, even if the policy is there and the demand from clients there, you had the benefit of timing and that worked out really well for projects. I know other projects that fail because they don't have that timing or storage still to set up.
I'd just say someone needs to invent the eBay for construction projects. That's really, like, that. If that exists, then there's a lot of things. But I would also just say, just talk to your clients about it. Tell them what exists and have the numbers with the QS beforehand. so that people get driven by money more than carbon. And one of the things as to why people knock down and rebuild is because you don't pay VAT on new build, and you pay it. So I think it's probably more the reverse of a carbon tax. And apparently, I haven't fact-checked this. I heard it from somewhere else, so sorry if it's wrong, but it makes sense. The reason why you have tax on retrofits is because you can't tell the difference between when you're doing DIY at home versus when you're doing a grand project. So some clever accountant can come up with a way of that, then that will change things, because at the moment it is cheaper quite often to knock down, because actually paying a demo contractor to not be careful is a lot cheaper than paying someone to be careful.
I just got two minor points to make, and I think there's the stick approach, which I appreciate and I probably agree with, the carbon tax. Actually, what we're finding is we've got clients approaching us and they're saying, actually, Tom, we can get preferential borrowing rates if we hit letty targets. And do you think you can hit these? And we're like, yeah, absolutely, we can do that. That's fine. So actually, there are carrots out there as well for developers and investors to go and get cheaper money to do their developments. I think a more pragmatic point, we live in a bit of a London bubble. We have to appreciate that, and we've made the point before that if you go out into the regions, there isn't the focus on it, there isn't the rents, there isn't the yields on buildings to allow for more novel approaches. And actually, we're quite lucky in London that we've got a host of consultancies, engineering especially, who are willing to push the boundaries, do novel things, try out different materials, and we've got clients who are willing to go with us on that journey. But fundamentally, we don't have that across the country. And therefore, we've got a software industry that's set up to provide engineers with software that designs concrete and steel primarily. And therefore, for reuse has to be a large part of what we do, because most of the engineers aren't going to go and do a post-tension, you know, stone beam or something, you know, crazy that we would do, or something, you know, a big timber building that HGS would do. You know, it's different, and therefore we need the market to evolve to allow for all engineering practices to be able to deliver low carbon buildings. And I think that's a huge driver, that the engineers will start pushing this because they have to. But the point we've spoken about two suppliers for steelwork, and on all buildings that we've got, we've got, you know, hundreds of buildings go through the office every year where we could take all the reused steel that's available to market. And actually everybody in this room who is on a project has a responsibility to make sure that the materials in your buildings and your developments get back into the supply chain, and we don't see dollar signs when our demolition contractors say, don't worry about the steelwork, we'll take that away for free. And they'll take it away for free because they'll take it and get it recycled, and they get £150 a tonne for it, and they'll pocket that. So actually what we need to be saying is, no, actually what we want, that's our steelwork, not your steelwork. We want £600 a tonne, and we want that to get back into the market. And I think it's changing the mindset of client bodies, development bodies, to say, actually, this asset, and Gareth said it, this asset has value, and all the parts of that asset have value.
I think we've got time for one more question, and then...
Surely we need to get the government to do it on their own portfolio, because they own more property than almost anyone else, and they own almost more dilapidated property than anyone else. And so if you're on an eBay for material, they're the ones that own it.
Okay, who would like that one then?
What's the question, David?
So the reality is, I'm afraid, is that sticks don't work particularly. All research shows that sticks are a less effective incentive than carrots. The government needs money, and it's got resource. So I suppose my question is how do you get it from the Club Pelleton Collective into Treasury and into whichever one of the government departments wants to pick it up? That's still not a question, but anyway.
Well, do you know what? I think there is an interesting governmental point on this, and it's to do with carbon. And this is only a theory, and I'm not yet found anybody who can prove me wrong. The government doesn't care about embodied carbon because nothing is manufactured here anymore. the steel we use here, the carbon cost of that is in Korea, it's in Russia, it's in Eastern Europe, it's in South America. There's a little bit of carbon cost in Southwest Wales. So why do they care about it? The carbon cost is somewhere else. Somebody else is dealing with that headache. It counts to their numbering system. So if we said, well, no, actually, we're going to count the cost of carbon for your country at the point of placing the carbon. So therefore, if you're a large importer of materials like the UK is, then you're going to have a cost. Maybe it's a carrot, maybe it's not. We can debate that till cows come home. You would have a phenomenal amount of carbon over London because of the amount of material that's placed here. And I think that's, to me, is a big change. Would be a big change in mindset. If the carbon you imported via materials, etc., was counted to your country's carbon numbers, I think they would care about it a lot more. And that would then start driving that kind of systemic change that we might need.
I think actually what's being posed is a good call to arms as well about how we do tackle government and their portfolio, and it'd be worth looking at their portfolio spend, be it MOD or their land assets, to identify where that money is going and get them to practice what they're preaching. So maybe that is something, building on the tradition of Club Peloton, where great ideas emerge from these discussions that we can take forward as a group. But thank you very much for your questions, and I think I heard your alarm go off, so we must be over time. So let's go to drinks, but thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.